My, not opinion, but my observation and my understanding of it. When you mentioned the Higgs, the particle that you just mentioned, this, the Higgs boson or whatever it is that what they refer to sometimes as the God particle?
Yes, indeed. Talk about hyperbole. A fascinating object that was theorized decades ago. And when it was finally discovered, three people got Nobel Prizes. It's a fascinating force carrier that gives fundamental particles their gravity. Not all particles. Some people get that kind of wrong. It gives electrons their gravitational force. It does not totally give atoms their force. In other words, if you just turned off the Higgs field, and you can't do that, thankfully, because it would cause other problems, you wouldn't be that much lighter, because a lot of the gravitational force, if you will, the mass is another way of we describe it, is based on things other than the Higgs field. But that's the Higgs field is the force, the Higgs boson is the force carrier for a thing called the Higgs field, which is the way that fundamental particles manifest mass.
If you were about a hydrogen collider. Interesting concept, because you have two beams of particles that travel close at the speed of light before they collide. They are in opposite direction in separate beam pipes. Those pipes are in ultra high vacuum, and at the chilling temperature of minus 271.3 centigrade, minus. The temperature of boiling nitrogen, if I remember, is 178 degrees. You could say a few words about how it compares to Kelvin and to action.
Again, I'm not quite sure what the question is. People are coming up with all kinds of fascinating ways to throw the most massive objects at the fastest speed at a target and free up some particles that have a very short lifespan. So they're using particle antiparticle, and they're accelerating both in the opposite direction and colliding them. So that gives you twice the momentum that just heating up a single element and shooting it at a target is. So all these things are geared to increasing the velocity and the momentum. Well, really, it's ultimately the momentum that counts. The greater the momentum of the object hitting the target, the higher the electron volt potentials, and they're seeking higher and higher electron volt potentials, because at those high energies, there's a wonderful theory out there to sort of explain things called supersymmetry. A supersymmetry assumes that there's a whole bunch of particles that we are totally unaware of. And the reason why we don't see it, they say, is because it's unstable at the energy levels that we see in our planet. So they're trying to bring up the power level so that they see the supersymmetry particles. They thought they were going to do that years ago, and they did get the Higgs boson. They did not get any supersymmetry particles. So supersymmetry may be a wonderful theory that's completely worthless. People are just kind of estimating that the electron volt effective masses are much, much higher than even CERN is capable of.
I have a quick question about superconductors.
Yeah, sure, George.
Back to a question I had asked earlier about the length of antennas and the resonance. I understand. I think I'm starting to understand resonance and frequency as well. But I mean, I remember when I was younger, a computer being about the size of a small building, two stories high. And now we have cell phones that have like a million times the computing power of that. Now that's a different thing. But I was thinking in terms of antenna and antenna size. Is it not possible to create the equivalent of size, you know, or length, because you have to have the right frequency? I understand that the signal goes to one end, bounces back, and you don't want to hit each other on the way back. But is there a way to create a circuit where you could create length using superconductors and therefore create smaller and more efficient antennas that are resonant at those frequencies?
Okay, that's an interesting one. In effect, you don't have to. There's two types of resonance. There's mechanical resonance, which is just being a half wave. That's mechanically a half wave. You can shorten a half wave dipole, and it will go out of resonance. And then you can electronically resonate it with an impedance matching circuit. And it's possible to shrink down. Dick K2RIW used to do this bit on the infinitesimal dipole. It is theoretically possible to shrink a dipole down to a minuscule size as long as you have a relatively lossless electronic resonating circuit built into it. That's the problem. They usually are not completely lossless. They're usually a bit lossless. Whether it would improve it to be superconducting, I'm not quite sure, but you know, the expense of maintaining cryogenics would probably ruin it that way.
That actually answered my question.
Well, that's the point of the exercise, I think.
So until we can figure out a way, if ever, to totally eliminate and have absolute zero loss, the antennas are going to have to remain the size that they are.
Well, like all things, it depends upon the amount of efficiency that you need. Your cell phone is a little tiny antenna. Without the electronic resonating circuit built into it, it wouldn't operate, but it does. Not at 100% efficiency, but at a tolerable efficiency. So shortened antennas do exist. Getting back to the story about the hamstick. Hamstick is basically a shortened vertical with a large resting inductor at the base, that springy-looking thing, and it electronically resonates the antenna. Unfortunately, there's a lot of insertion loss involved. But if you must absolutely positively transmit on 160 meters and you have, say, a 200-watt amplifier and you only need about 1 or 2 watts to go out of your antenna, then that's better than no antenna at all.
Sure. I mean, I understand that the cell phone. I understand the cell phone antenna. Because, I mean, you're limited. The cell phone antenna is limited, and that's why you have the repeaters that you depend on for your cell phone service. And that's apparently because of the loss of the signal in the cell phone, or the loss of efficiency that causes you to have not a pure antenna. In my verbiage, that. Transmit, I'm getting verbose, so I'm going to drop it.
ACC, yes. It's not quite that simple, unfortunately. Also, it has a lot to do with the frequency band. Cell phones use microwaves, which have one good benefit, that they go through a bunch of things. So, you know, when you go into a house, your signal doesn't completely die. The downside is the absorption and attenuation is much greater than lower frequency. So it's a combination of factors.
Thank you, Roy. I appreciate that. I understand what you're talking about.
Matter of fact, one of the problems with 5G is 5G is basically a method to increase the amount of the symbol rate. How much data you can suck up using a 5G cell phone. And to do that, they've simply taken over more of the microwave frequencies, which include the higher microwave bands. But distance, the higher you go, the more the attenuation loss. They've had to populate areas with more higher concentration of cell towers if they're going to optimally utilize 5G technology at the higher frequencies.
That's similar to in the old days, we used to have like 16-bit throughput and 32-bit and 64K. Is the 5G, does that mean that they're transmitting 5 gigahertz packages? Is that the similar thing?
No. People get that confused. And matter of fact, there was a funny article I read recently where if you go to Amazon, you can find what they call a Faraday cage for your router. The idea, bizarrely, is that your router, your Wi-Fi is putting out 5G, and it's injurious to your health. So if you put this thing that looks like a wire mesh, a wastebasket over your router, it'll only block the 5G signal. 5G is not 5 gigahertz. It's problematic because it's the fifth generation, but that's the only thing that means when they say 5G. It has nothing to do with the number of gigahertz. It's a much wider swath of frequencies that 5G uses.
Okay, so it has nothing to do with gigahertz. Okay, yeah, I mean, Faraday cages, I mean, Tesla used to use them. I mean, doesn't that protect you from, like, extremely high voltage? And you could also use them to protect electronics from, like, an EMP or something like that.
It limits the amount of electromagnetic radiation that reaches you. It has no effect for DC, obviously, because of that. And depending upon the quality of the Faraday cage, if it's solid metal, then it's pretty good for most frequencies. If it's mesh, it depends upon the dimensions of the mesh, and also it depends upon the density of the metal. It doesn't block things entirely, it attenuates things. So if you have a 10,000 watt signal and it drops it by 50%, that's nice, but it's still probably going to injure you. So Faraday cages are not absolute. They attenuate signal. Something like a power supply box will probably shield something like 120 dB of isolation of RF frequency, which means 10 to the width to 12 zeros. But, some are better than others. The waste paper mesh basket, I think, is not a great Faraday cage. It's mostly a scam, obviously.
Understood. Great.
Yeah, but it's kind of amusing what hucksters will pull. So somehow they think they've talked people into thinking that 5G signals are coming from their 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi routers. I think that's the scam going.
I actually, things like that, I look at that as a measure of the relative ignorance of the world. If the mass intelligence was of higher intellect, there wouldn't be hucksters like that because people would just know better. And the fact that people like that exist and they seem to predominate, I mean, every commercial I see, it infuriates me. And it insults me that it's like they whoever's producing these, they're not saying that I'm ignorant, but I mean, there must be a lot of ignorant people out there based on the quality of or the intelligence of the advertising and commercials I've seen.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't want to upset any teachers out there, but I have gotten the sense that the educational system has sort of let people down. Wesley and John used to discuss this, and occasionally I would drop in and discuss this at the wee hours when Limark's repeater was up in the middle of the night. There's a lack of critical thinking in many people, and there's a lack of curiosity and or interest. I've known people who tell me how a radio works, and they tell me you plug it in, you turn it on. That's how the radio works. Well, if that is your limitations of knowledge that you're not going to traverse, there's going to be a problem down the road somewhere. You need people to fix things. Thankfully, we have people like Andy, WA2CDL, but it's always nice for you to know how your stuff actually works.
Sure, my dad used to teach me that a liberal education in things like mathematics and logic and things of those natures, that if you learn that, it actually taught you how to think. Whereas it seems like the educational directive these days is not so much in teaching you how to think for yourself, but it seems like it's more teaching you what to think.
I'm not sure if there is any thought process going on. I think many people don't like liberal education because they're too vague for them. They would probably prefer people to be taught a productive trade necessary to society. It strikes me as very, very Brave New World-ish. You know, any day now, I'm waiting to see if they're going to decant alpha and beta, gamma and delta people.
That's a scary thought.
Yes, Wes. Just before we move to you, Wes. You know, genetic engineering is a fascinating subject. They did it to form the messenger RNA vaccines that hopefully will help us get out of the coronavirus problem. But, you know, like any tool, I tell people that hammers are very useful. You can build a house with a hammer, but you can also cave in your neighbor's skull. So tools are very useful, but in the wrong hands can be very dangerous. So what do you want to say, Wes?
I quickly went to, because you made a comment about then RF in superconducting temperature. So I quickly went to Google and I just punched antenna in superconducting temperature and I found so much of work that has been done. Hundreds of articles of superconducting loop antennas, superconductors in antennas, behavior in very low temperature of superconductivity when in high superconductivity temperature. So it is a lot of work that has been done here, and by not only by major institutions, but also by commercial applications. Intuition.
Okay, I mean, there's lots of research in lots of fields. The problem is right now our understanding, type 1 superconductors, almost no one outside of commercial venues has a means to freeze things down. So you're stuck with type 2 superconductors, and they have a whole bunch of problems. They tend to be brittle, or they fall apart at certain physical stresses. Or, like the latest sort of room temperature superconductor, you need a diamond anvil and megapascals of pressure in order to make them work. And as soon as you let go on the pressure, it loses its superconductor. So it's interesting as a research project. It might be useful as an industrial or government where the budget is whatever you want, but in consumer field, superconductors aren't quite ready for prime time.
I absolutely agree. Think about this. We have electronics in the cell phone. There are a bunch of capacitors, a bunch of resistors, and most of them are implemented on microchip. And then you want to create a superconducting antenna. Yeah, per tier, you could use per tier pump. I have a pump that I have a whole chamber that could go to. It says below 4.5 Kelvin. 4.5 Kelvin, so it's what? It's pretty close to the temperature in the space. It probably would go very much lower than that. That's what it says. But anyhow, the electronic would not work. So my problem I never thought about that. Just pop up to my mind. We have a space, we have a temperature in space, and then we have electronics, and we have a transmitter that operates in space. How the heck they did it? If our cell phone, we put it into a superconducting temperature, it wouldn't work. That's what.
Well, that's a wonderful opportunity to slide it over to the space report, which is due any second now. I assume that in the cold, dark, faraway regions of space, it's that cold. When the sun shines on these objects, when they're not terribly far from the sun, it heats up rather quickly, and the electronic circuitry has waste heat as well. So it's not as simple as the temperature of the surrounding space in darkness, far, far away from any sun.
So you say that all of the satellites are heated? None of them is in darkness?
Well, I'll leave that as a dangling question for Paul, because he knows more about these things than I do. But I would assume that there's some thermal waste for the electronics of all of these devices, and there's probably some kind of heater element that reinforces it. When it's near sunlight, it needs a lot less. When it's totally out of, nowhere near the sun, it probably burns more of its electrical fuel.
Interesting. How did they get the transmitters that still transmit, or even the transceiver that allows the two-way communication for the deep space satellites or deep space spaceships that you see there?
But, what size antenna could they possibly have? I mean, it's got to be absolutely a directional type of antenna, but still, it's got to be an absolutely small antenna. And how is it possibly transmitted through millions of miles of space?
Well, the trick there tends to be that you need a very, 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 very big antenna here, which is why you can't hook up something and listen into the satellites. You can listen into the local satellites that are transmitting enough power, but for all those lovely little spacecraft that NASA keeps an eye on, they need massive communication systems to suck the femtowatts of RF that spray out all over the place. I mean, they do have somewhat directional antennas, but yeah, the crosshair, the area, surface area of those antennas is not enormous.
Actually, as soon as you said that, it's not the size of the receiving antenna. It just kind of answered my question immediately.
Okie dokie. I had loads of fun chatting with you guys. I hope you learned something new, something to think about, and maybe come back and rejoin the discussion. I hope I haven't bored the other people who were more interested in antennas and BizWa and such. Want to thank everyone, as always, for participating, because without participants, I would just be babbling to myself. Want to remind everyone that if you have any questions and you can't get onto the technical net, or topics you want covered, or puzzles you want me to offer people, or to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at a space report, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the link page for articles or YouTube that interest me or have something to do with discussions here on the TechNet is roy.ac2gs.com. And always keep in mind MikeKC2NJI's website, where he archives the technical net going as far back as September 2006 at amateurradio.tv. So, again, want to thank everyone and introduce Paul for the Space and Net Report. And if you could put a few more words, if you will, on how these transmitters, do they have internal heating systems just to keep them at some nominal temperature?
AC2GS, WS2N, good evening, Roy and everybody else. And Yeah, we spent a little time on the chat room as well. We had some people there tonight, Roy. I know you're busy with the net, but they're there. And as far as the voyages are concerned, first of all, I'm on the Eastern Repeater. How's my signal?
It's a little crackly, but it's completely understandable.
Okay, no, I've heard the crackles all night long from everybody. And then once in a while, it tends to go away. Yeah, Voyager, the two Voyagers, one and two, are they do have heaters. And power is being driven by a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, essentially plutonium that's decaying. And it's surrounded by graphite, like graphite blankets. And inside the graphite blankets is a whole bunch of these thermocouples. They put out a slight voltage, but you put enough of them together, some in series and some in parallel. Next thing you know, you're going to boost your voltage and your amperage up to something that you're going to need. It's usually with the Voyagers, I think it was a 109-watt capability. And with that, they had three of those on board, on Voyager. So with those RTGs, they were able to run heaters. They have like tiny little pipes that run off the plutonium. So you're not necessarily taking the electricity from the plutonium. You're taking the heat from the plutonium that heat travels through teeny tiny pipes to the different electronic components on a spacecraft. And I think the George asked about the size of the antenna. It's a 12-foot dish. 12-foot dish, and you use the, they've got this traveling wave tube, and it's still operating all these years, transmitting around 25 watts. The wattage is going down as the years go on, but it started off around 25, 30 watts. And that's all they're using. I think they're transmitting 8 gig. Transmitting frequency. I think you should know the exact frequency. I have it written down here somewhere. But, that's pretty much what they do in the receiving frequency. You're dealing with the X-band and I think it was the S-band. But that's pretty much what they're using. And that's why they're able to keep the transmitters running all these years. They've cut out a lot of the cameras and motors and things that they don't need anymore because the power of the RTGs starts to drop off around 4% of every year.
Remember back in the early days, Apollo program that the Apollo astronauts were actually the first reason that they could, when they were on the ground, they could communicate between the capsule and the command center.
Rory got away from the radio for a second. Anyway, and as far as receiving, we have three locations on Earth, 120 degrees apart: Goldstone, California; Madrid, Spain; and Canberra, Australia. And there's a lot of different antennas in those locations that they use for different purposes. But one of the purposes is to contact Voyager. And Deep Space Network has rebuilt one of the antennas in Australia. And they got another one that's going to come online. It's been down since March. So they've been unable to use that directly for Voyager. But they can, they transmit to Voyager, but they can hear it because they use what Roy was talking about before, interferometry between two antennas, two different locations, and it kind of acts like one big antenna. So they can hear it, but I think within another, a couple of months, they'll be able to transmit on a regular basis back up to the Voyager. And the reason one, you know, they went out at two different locations. One, Voyager 2 and Voyager 1. One is going down south of the ecliptic plane. That's the one we're kind of losing. It can only be contacted with the Australian antenna. But the other Voyager, no problem. They can still use Canberra, Madrid and Goldstone in California. So that's the story on Voyager. Let me continue on with the normal part of the SpaceNet report. This is Paul WS2N. Right, any questions about the Voyager before I go on?
Fantastic, thank you.
You're welcome. You know, that's been a few years. That Voyager topic has always been a great topic. Dick used to love the Voyager topic. K2RIW, he loves to bring that up every now and then. So we've kind of gone over that many, many times, but they're still flying. I mean, they took off 1977, and they're still doing good. Four times the distance of Pluto. They're way out there. You send a signal out to one of them, and it takes I think 37 hours or something to get there, another 37 hours to come back, something like that. At the speed of light. But they have a website, Voyager website, and they tell you that. You click into Voyager, and they'll tell you. They'll give you a lot of information about those two spacecraft. Anyway, usually I start off with the newest launches that are coming up, but right now there's two International Space Station sightings that are coming up. There was one tonight that I saw. It was very good. But there's one tomorrow night and one on Tuesday night, which should be very bright. They call it a negative 4.5 and a negative 4.3 magnitude, which is very bright. You know, you get anything over, let's say, negative 1.1, you know, anything brighter than that, it really stands out. By the way, the negative number, in other words, the lower the number, the brighter it is. Like the sun is like minus 27 or something. But this is negative 4.5 tomorrow night and Tuesday. Monday night, you have, just at dusk, around 5:46 p.m. That's when it'll start, and then it'll last for around 5.5 minutes. And it'll go to 5:52 p.m., but it'll go right over your house. I mean, it'll start off on the horizon in the northwest, and then it'll rise right over you, right over our houses, 85 degrees above the horizon, and then it will drop down and go to the southeast. So I think it's only going to be a few clouds out tomorrow night. It should be pretty good. Temperatures aren't too cold. Put a heavy coat on, and if you go out there exactly at that time, you'll start to see it in the northwest. And that would be again 5:46 p.m. And then the following night, Tuesday, you'll be able to see it also at 4:59, and you'll have a duration a little longer of 6 minutes and 38 seconds, and that will go to, you won't be as high in the sky. It'll be 57 degrees, but it's still pretty high, you know, like 60 degrees. That should be a very good sighting on Tuesday night. Again, cold and not too many clouds.
Describing there is the space station in a polar orbit?
Oh no, negative. It's the space station is on an inclination of 56.2 degrees off the equator. So you know that's where it that's where it sits. They established that years ago, but just over 50 degrees, think of it that way. So they established that years ago when Russia had the Mir space station. It was the same inclination. And the reason that Russia had it there was that was their launching point, you know, roughly around that, those that degree inclination they were launching from Baikonur, Russia. And then when we teamed up with Russia, we agreed to keep that inclination. This way they'll be able to get up to the space station. We could have had one on the equator. It didn't matter. But we chose to match their inclination. So back to you.
I have a book by Arthur C. Clarke, my father's Arthur Clarke actually autographed from when he worked, when my dad worked at IBM. He wrote a book, Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book, The Making of a Moon, which basically chronicles the early days of the United States satellite program. And non-equatorial satellites, the more incidence of angle you put into them, the more they cover the Earth, the faster and more effectively they cover the Earth from maybe a surveillance or an intelligence perspective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely right. Definitely. Yeah, if it was just on the equator, you wouldn't be able to get, you wouldn't be able to see what's going up near Alaska or down near South America. You wouldn't know what they were doing down in Argentina or Australia. So, yes, that's very true. But it's relatively low, compared to your geosynchronous satellite, 250 miles up. Your geosynchronous satellites are 23,000 miles up. So. Okay, today we had a launch by SpaceX, and they called the CRS 21, the cargo resupply service that NASA has signed. NASA has signed SpaceX up to too many years ago, and over the years SpaceX has launched now 20 cargo vehicles, and all to the International Space Station to resupply it. And this is the 21st, but this one's a little different because they've changed the design of the cargo vehicle. It's version 2. It looks a lot like the crew version. They've done away with the big solar panels that used to fold out after the spacecraft separated from the second stage. And instead what they have is the solar cells are attached to the body of the spacecraft itself, to what they call the trunk, the back end of the vehicle. So, after launch, it's actually generating power as it's still on the second stage. They don't need to open the panels and then initiate the panels to start creating electricity. They don't have to wait for that. Also, they do away with a lot of weight. They didn't need that weight. They didn't need the motors. So what they can do is add payload to the cargo vehicle. With that and a few other things that they cut back on, they're able to add 20% more volume and more weight to the cargo vehicle that is now on the way to the space station. It will dock tomorrow. And it will dock to one of the modules. You have a dozen different modules that people are living on in the space station. There's 7 people up there right now. And one of the modules that they're going to dock to is the Harmony node. You have different nodes, 3 nodes. You have the Unity node, and you have a whole bunch of different modules that can connect to the Unity node. Then you have another node in the front called the Harmony node, and that's where this one is going to dock to. And then there's another one called the Tranquility node, and that one's off to the starboard side. Now, each node has six different openings where you can attach things to. So the Harmony node in the front, it has the pressure mating adapter attached to it, which is the adapter that that they use to dock to any spacecraft that's coming up right now. In this case, the Crew Dragon 21. You have two different locations that you can dock right now on the space station for the American side. And both locations are located on this Harmony node. One is in the front, and right now Dragon crew vehicle is attached to that. And this one is going to be attached to the Zenith port. You know, the one on top of the Harmony node. Now, remember, Harmony is it's a living quarters. It's like 33 feet long and 14 feet in diameter. So if you were inside, it would be like a big room. And that's where it's going to dock to tomorrow. The crew that's going to access it now, and the crew, by the way, is not even going to touch it. This is all going to be autonomous. They're just going to watch it fly in. So, like I said before, you have seven people now on board. Recently, last month, you had four people go up on a crew Dragon vehicle. And they all happen to be hams. One is Sharon Walker, KD5DXD. Michael Hopkins, another ham, with a call letter of KF5LJG. Victor Glover, with another call letter of KI5DKC. And Sochi Noguchi, he comes out of Japan, but trained in the United States. So he wound up with an American call letter. KD5, TVP, Tango Victor Papa. And when they docked, they met three other astronauts that were up there, two Russians, and another woman astronaut named Kate Rubin, also with a call letter, KG5FYJ. So you have plenty of people up there that can operate those ham radios. So I'm sure they're going to make some school contacts with ARIS amateur radio on the International Space Station group that arranges all of that type of work. So that should be good. Wish them luck. And that vehicle will stay attached to the space station for around 2 months anyway. And they'll load it up with trash and stuff that they don't need. They'll also load it up with scientific equipment. This thing is reusable. So whatever science has to come back, they'll put it on board this cargo vehicle. And it will eventually deorbit. You know, it'll undock by itself and then deorbit. Parachutes, heat shield parachutes. And then land in the Atlantic Ocean, where it will be picked up by a SpaceX ship. And they'll be able to put it right on the ship with hydraulic lift. And they'll be able to get the scientific experiments that scientists love to get their hands on right away, immediately. So that's the story on that flight. But before it comes back, while it's attached to the Tranquility node or module at that Zenith location, in the back, well, you have to understand that the Dragon vehicle is the front end of it, and that's where all the pressurized stuff is, and then the back end of it is called the trunk, and that's where the solar panels are, that's where the heat radiators are to get rid of the excess heat that's inside this thing. You know, the crew can go in there and live in there, actually. They could, like an extra room for a while, and they're able to load everything into the space station, food and science equipment. But in the truck, in the back, is another piece that's going to be attached to the International Space Station, and it's called the Bishop. Now, the Bishop is another airlock system that has been paid for by NASA, but a private company has built it. They've been working on this for about 5 years or so. Bishop will be removed with the robotic arm, and the Canadian robotic arm that's attached to the space station. And it will be pulled from the spacecraft, and it will be installed on another node. Like I said, there was the Tranquility node, there's the Unity node. Well, there's another one on the port side, which is called the Unity module, and then this thing is attached to the Harmony module. The other one is called Tranquility. This Bishop thing is going to be attached to the end of the Tranquility module. And once it's installed, the crew will have another airlock to use, not for people, but for sending satellites out. Sometimes they send up small satellites to the space station that have to be shot off into space. Well, for now they have one such gadget, and it's an airlock that's attached to one of the Japanese modules called the Kibo module. Kibo module has this small door that opens up, and you're able to put maybe something the size of a microwave oven or something inside it. You'd be able to push it through, and then they depressurize it, and then you can shoot it out into space. This Bishop thing is a lot bigger. You can put in items that are easy, 5 or 6 times bigger than a microwave. In fact, you can probably put something in as big as a refrigerator inside the Bishop airlock. What they do is they close the inner door. All these modules have the inner doors. They close the inner door, and that separates the inside from space. And then they're able to depressurize the Bishop module. Robotic arm will be able to detach that Bishop module and then point it in a certain direction, and it'll be able to shoot off relatively large satellites if they need to. Or they'll be able to bring big pieces of equipment and have it located on the outside of the space station if they're going to do an EVA. If they're going to do a spacewalk, they need to put things on the outside of the spaceship, outside of the International Space Station. And they could, it'll cut back on a lot of EVA time if they do this type of thing. So it's got a lot of capabilities. And also it could be used multiple times, maybe I think a 5-to-1 ratio compared to what they used with the Kibo airlock system now. Now you might say, well, how did the astronauts get out? Well, the astronauts have nothing to do with these two airlocks. This is a thing, satellites, tools, and whatever has to be put on it on the outside of the space station. Experiments, maybe. But the astronauts go through on the American side, and then the Russians do their EVA. The Russians do their EVAs through a small module called the PIRS module on the Russian end of the space station. But on the American side, we have a larger module called the Quest airlock. And the Quest airlock consists of two rooms. One room you can get in, and you can put your spacesuit on, get ready. And they move into the second room, and that's near the end. They close another door, and now those two astronauts are stuck on the very end. They depressurize, and they open it up, and they're able to do an EVA. So that's the four ways of getting in and out of the International Space Station. You know, the only other way is to get into a spaceship and head home. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, very good. Well, that's the deal on the Bishop airlock, brought up by the new cargo vehicle built by SpaceX. The other topic I was going to cover is the foreign topic, China. China landed a vehicle on the moon. They launched from China just about a week or two ago. Spent some time getting near the moon, roughly about 5 days. They went into elliptical orbit, then they fired their engines again and went into a circular orbit. With that, they separated the landing vehicle from the orbiting vehicle, or like, let's call that the mothership that stays in orbit around the moon. And the lander started heading down to land on the moon. It landed near the Ocean of Storms, roughly a flat area on the moon. It's got four landing legs. Landed. It's got two little ramps that that they're able to utilize. Anyway, it had had a drill on it, a big drill, and it drilled into the lunar surface. Around 2 meters, they said. So roughly, you know, 6 or 7 feet into the ground. And a bunch of pulverized moon dust, I guess, comes up. And they're able to collect that up with a scoop from a robotic arm that they had on board. And they put that stuff inside the top part of the spacecraft. Because the top part of the spacecraft consisted of an ascent vehicle. So they're going to use the bottom part of the vehicle as the launch pad, similar to what we did with the LEMS when we went to the moon with astronauts. The ascent vehicle was able to take off, successfully did, and now, last I heard, it did dock with the the mothership, the orbiting vehicle. And I haven't heard that they transferred the roughly 5 pounds of stuff that they got from the moon. There's a canister that will slide from one vehicle to the other, from the ascent vehicle to the mothership or the return ship. I haven't heard that was done yet. My guess by now it probably has been. Then they said they're going to wait in orbit, keep orbiting the moon for a period of time, waiting for a proper window to open, so that they could deorbit the moon and have this thing eventually come back to Earth and land in Mongolia, Upper Mongolia, you know, part of China. That's where it's going to come through the atmosphere, heat shield, you know, 25,000 miles an hour. That's the speed you're going when you come back from the moon. A couple of parachutes, and then it's going to land on the in China. It will be the third country that has done this. We have done it many times with the LEMS. We had six landings with the LEMS over the years, and collectively we brought back over 840 pounds of rock. So they got a long way to catch us. And the Russia did it as well. With Luna 24, they called it. That was they had three missions like that. If they had sent a vehicle to the moon in what I think 1976, they did the same thing. The only thing is they didn't have a mothership going around. They had a direct return.
That time complete
launched off from the moon. That vehicle just kept going right back to Russia. So that's the story on China landing on the moon.
Any questions or comments? WSTM.
KC1SAM.
Good evening, Sam. KC1SAM, WS2N.
Hi, Paul. Nice to hear you. I think they have a ship on the way to Mars, don't they? And if they do, I think you might be looking to pull off a similar mission on Mars without saying anything. Bring back a sample.
Yes, yeah, Sam, they would love to be that far along, but they are pretty far along. Yeah, right now there's three different separate missions on the way to Mars. And China is one of them, and they have, well, they're over halfway there. So the other missions, one by the United Arab Emirates and one by the USA, and we're all over halfway there to the to Mars. But yeah, when China gets there, they're gonna go into lunar orbit with their mission, and then they've got to decide on whether they would like to land on Mars. So eventually, when they do that, they're gonna separate the vehicles. They'll leave the orbiter in Mars, around Mars, and you'll have a descent vehicle, and that will land on Mars. And this one is not coming back, like the full mission. But it does have a little rover on board. It weighs a couple hundred pounds. Solar paneled rover. And it's going to drive off the top of the vehicle. It's got a little ramp. And what's going to happen is they're going to use that orbiting spacecraft still in orbit around Mars as a communication relay device. So that's the deal with those guys. The United Arab Emirates, they hitchhiked a ride on a Japanese rocket back in the summer. And they don't have a lander. They're just going to go into orbit around Mars. So that's their goal. But we do have a lander. We have one heck of a lander. We've got Perseverance, they gave it a name, and that's going to land on Mars. 2,200-pound vehicle on Earth, anyway. Don't weigh that on Mars. It's one-third the weight on Mars. And another six-wheeled vehicle, similar to Curiosity. A little bit bigger, a little bit heavier than Curiosity. Again, with a close plutonium RTG radioisotope thermoelectric generator on it. So we'll be able to keep on going. So will China if they have if the sun doesn't get clouded out by one of those dust storms that they have on Mars now and then. So back to you, Sam. You're right. China's on the way to Mars along with some of us and United Arab Emirates. European Space Agency was supposed to do the same, but they had some problems with their parachute, so they're going to delay until 2 years from now, and then they'll do it. They have a rover going. Back to you, Sam.
KC1FM. You're not good to have parachute problems. Yeah, I just wondered. I know they had something going, and I wondered if they were going to do something like that there. I'll give them a big scoop. I'll give them some big headlines. Okay. I appreciate it. I think it's back to you. I'm just looking. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, very good. And looking forward to Perseverance landing. I mean, Curiosity landed 2012, still going. So that's as long as they can get this thing on the ground, we'll have another one of those things that'll last another 10, 12 years, who knows how long. We'll have two of them riding around on Mars again, like we used to have with Spirit and Opportunity. So, after some of the time, usually we end around 11. I just want to mention, there is one rocket that I'm paying attention to. I always like the new guys that are trying to get into this field. There's a rocket company called Astra. Astra's
trying to put a commercial rocket into space. And they tried last year, and they had a problem, it didn't work out, and the pandemic got in the way, and they tried again.